Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, a Republican National Convention that broke all the rules. Defying public health guidance, President Trump accepted the Republican nomination in front of a packed crowd on the South Lawn of the White House Thursday night with few face coverings in sight. As my guest, New York Times opinion columnist Frank Bruni says, this has been the story of the Republicans' convention message, with speaker after speaker presenting a picture of America that does not line up with reality. But was it still effective? I asked Frank Bruni Friday morning. What did you make of the Republican National Convention this week, Frank?
A couple of things, Diane, really struck me. I mean, one was, listen, I mean, Democrats do this. Everyone does this at political conventions. They do it in campaigns. They pretty up the truth. They give the version of history and the version of their candidate that is going to sell best, right? So, I mean, the truth is never adhered to stringently. I don't think I've ever watched a convention in my lifetime that so fully reinvented the candidate in question. I mean, when I listen to these various speakers talk about Donald Trump as the most empathetic person, you just don't see it, as the most tireless worker, when we know he spends a lot of time golfing and watching Fox News in the White House, it wasn't like they kind of gave you the best version of Trump. It was like they hallucinated an entirely new person in his place. That really struck me. And the other thing that really struck me, Diane, was the Democrats, we saw all their recent living presidents. We saw a lot of different montages of Democratic luminaries from recent decades. In the Republican convention, it was as if the party went from Abraham Lincoln, who was brought up again and again, straight to Donald Trump. And I thought that was fascinating because I think it reflected a few things. One is so many recent Republican luminaries, recent Republican presidents, presidential nominees want nothing to do with Donald Trump. But also, this is no longer a political party on a continuum. It is a kind of personality cult, as people have said. And so it's Trump, Trump, Trump. There's no need to connect him to a Republican tradition because he's exploded the Republican tradition.
And last night, with his final acceptance speech and 1,000 people on the White House lawn, most of them not wearing masks. I mean, what do you make of that kind of spectacle that he is putting forth to the American people, saying, here are all my trappings. I am doing everything so brilliantly that here are all my people coming to the White House.
I'm glad you brought up the crowd. And by the way, I looked very carefully, as I'm sure you did, and they were sitting cheek by jowl.
I mean,
it's not just that there wasn't 6 feet between them. In some cases, there was barely 6 inches between them, right? That made me very, very angry. And I think if people watch it in a skeptical and intelligent way, it tells them everything about this president and this presidency. It made me angry because that is not the behavior to be modeled right now if we want to keep American citizens safe and healthy. But safety, sanity took a backseat to spectacle, I think is the word you just used, and that's a perfect word. Donald Trump always puts spectacle above all else, and this was a very vivid visual demonstration of it. And the other thing is, I mean, as you mentioned, they were at the White House. That, of course, in and of itself is a very bold and controversial decision because the White House is not traditionally supposed to be used for a political convention, for a partisan event of this nature. And he not only used it, but he sort of reveled in it almost naughtily. I mean, he came out, I mean, you know, he and Melania appeared on that portico or balcony. They took forever down the curved staircase. I mean, it was almost like, you know, something out of a king and queen regal thing. And then he mused about this wonderful house and its previous denizens. And then deeper into the speech, he actually turned around, looked at it, gestured at it, and said, we're here and they're not, taunting Democrats. And that, again, Donald Trump assoluta, that's exactly who he is. He's someone who thumbs his nose at traditions and norms, and his supporters seem to like that.
His supporters seem to like that, and yet at the same time, speaking of the virus and the risk that took place, I found it interesting that while Anthony Fauci was under anesthesia, the CDC changed its rules. What can you tell me about that?
Well, that is entirely, and I'm surprised that more of the reporting didn't bring this up. That was entirely consistent and of a piece with what Trump said, if you remember, at that Arizona rally, or was it Oklahoma? I'm sorry. The Tulsa rally, right? Where he said, I told them, like, slow down with the testing. We only had these big numbers because Donald Trump has made or tried to make various decisions in his administration to make the numbers look better, to make the statistics look better. And if you tell the CDC, let's narrow, you know, the criteria for whom we test, you're going to have fewer positive tests, right? I mean, that's what I make of it. We lead the world by far in recorded coronavirus-related deaths. And it is important to use that word recorded because it could well be that China wasn't honest in their count, et cetera. So we got to put that word in there. But we lead the world by far. We lead the world by far in reported, recorded coronavirus infections. We do not lead the world in population. So that's not the explanation for this. Those numbers I just mentioned, or those world ranks, are very difficult for Donald Trump to run away from as he's running for re-election. And so what I make of the CDC stuff and all that is there is an attempt to try to somehow make sure those numbers don't go up too much higher between now and November 3rd.
And making that change while Fauci is under anesthesia really kind of got to me. Anthony Fauci is perhaps one of the, if not the most trusted voice on the virus in America. And therefore, to make that change about CDC reporting when he cannot publicly argue against it struck me as the height of going against everything that we know would be better for the American people.
Well, it sure does, but again, it is consistent with other actions in recent weeks and months. I mean, you are correct about how trusted Dr. Fauci is, and he has earned that trust. I mean, he's earned it over decades. I'm old enough to remember the AIDS crisis. I'm old enough to have reported on the AIDS crisis, and I'm pretty sure back then I interviewed Dr. Fauci on the phone. I mean, he was one of the nation's leading voices on that. He's now, you know, probably the nation's leading voice on coronavirus. But long before they did what you were just describing so well, you know, Trump has tweeted and said things publicly that undermined Dr. Fauci's credibility. You know, he's been wrong a lot. He has retweeted things from the right that were attacking Fauci. So this is the same behavior, different day. This is just, you know, slightly different circumstances, the same through line. And again, it shows the same thing that staging that spectacle with people without masks last night, it shows the same thing, which is that his political interests, Trump, if I may use that as a verb, responsible governance.
You said you wish that the press had covered this story a little more. What kind of a job do you think the press is doing on Trump's lying?
I think it's doing the best that it can in an impossible situation. And what I mean by that is when the lying is the default setting, right? Which it is with Trump. When it happens at the magnitude and with the frequency that it's happening, your calling it out becomes white noise to people, right? But I don't know what the alternative to that is. We live in such a fractured and partisan information ecosystem where almost everybody has used the kind of tools of the digital age to curate and filter their information and their newsfeed in a way that they have echoed back at them the precise reality they already ascribe to. I don't know how one covers Donald Trump in an effective way in terms of calling him out and unmasking him to whichever small segment of the population that is still forming impressions and willing to change their judgments over time. So at the end of the day, I think the media in this current information ecosystem is in an impossible situation.
That takes me to Nancy Pelosi's argument that Joe Biden should not debate Donald Trump because all he will do is lie. And how do the moderators call him out on those lies?
I could not have more respect for Nancy Pelosi in terms of, especially in terms of recent history. I think she's wrong about not debating Trump. I think there is a tradition here that is longer and larger than these two men. Yes, Trump is going to get up there and he's going to say whatever version of reality he wants to. It's what he did last night. It's what all the speakers at the Republican National Convention did. But part of the point of that is it gives Joe Biden an attempt to say, that's not quite right. Here are the facts. I think the moderators need to absolutely push back on what are demonstrable lies, but I think they have to be very careful about their tone and the way they do that. Because when it gets seen by people who kind of pay a more impressionistic attention to this stuff than perhaps you and I do, they're busy, they've got a lot going on in their lives, they're not kind of metaphorically sitting at their TV screens or computer screens with a magnifying glass and a fact check book at hand. I think tone is really important. When the media seems to be correcting and criticizing Donald Trump in an almost kind of bloodlust way or in a way that is that emphasizes humiliating him, I think it can turn off, again, that very small group of voters who are perhaps still movable. But I do think you can in real time say, excuse me, sir, that number you just cited, you know, that's not consistent with the record. Here it is. And Biden, if he prepares adequately for the debates, and I think he does have a lot of this information in his head already, he can do that too. I think debates are going to be fascinating. I have a whole different concern, which is I don't want Biden to be drawn into kind of a nasty tit for tat. I think the way to debate Donald Trump is almost to kind of tisk tisk, like, oh, there he goes again, and go on with what you want to say. I think if Joe Biden essentially seems unflustered, like Donald Trump is this gnat or this gnat buzzing around, I think that will drive Donald Trump insane. And I think Donald Trump in circumstances like that can be his own worst enemy.
Let me tell you how I'd like to see these debates. I'd like to see them done on Zoom with the two candidates in totally separate places and the moderators in a separate place and no live audience. I think a live audience really defeats the purpose of having a debate because of all their cheering and screaming and whistling and interrupting. What do you think of that?
I don't know about the Zoom part of it, but I think your point about a live audience is really, really well taken. And as you said it, I found myself, I'm sure people have discussed this in the past or whatever, but as you said, why is there that live audience? I thought, why haven't we asked that question and discussed it more? Because, you know, they take these great pains, I think, usually to make sure the audience isn't stacked in favor of one candidate or another. But it's so many debates you and I have watched over the years, one candidate's people are often louder than the other. And it changes the TV experience in a way that has nothing to do with what's going on. And you're right, if these debates are sort of supposed to be the most substantive parts of the campaign and are supposed to be driven by actual kind of information and facts and, you know, intellectual jousting, it's way too lofty a term for what happens. Yeah, why do we have an audience? I like that idea of no audience.
Me too. And I have posed it to the head of the debate committee. I'm not sure she's going to follow my suggestion because she continues to believe that the audience gives the debates energy and that energy inspires the two candidates.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, and I'm glad you pressed this. They don't have a clapping or hooting audience when they're in the Oval Office doing their job. That energy may have a lot to do with TV ratings. I'm not sure what that energy has to do with picking the right person to govern the country.
Tell me what you think of the fact that Kellyanne Conway has decided to leave the White House.
It's interesting. We talk about her leaving the White House and her stepping back. Her husband's also taking a professional step back. This is sort of a family project. And certainly she's the more newsworthy part of this because she's one of the longest serving aides and all that. But this does seem to be a family decision. And if one looks at the timeline, it seems very much reactive and responsive to the fact that their 15-year-old, I believe, daughter Claudia had begun on social media to like chronicle the family's woes. And I think that, you know, I think it became publicly embarrassing to them. And I think, and I'm gonna give them the best interpretation and benefit. I think they felt like, you know, we can continue at our various pursuits here. Kellyanne in the White House, me, George Conway at the Lincoln Project, you know, and on my Twitter feed, and watch our family disintegrate. Or we can say, wait a second, there is one thing here that's more important than partisan battle. And that's our family. And so I take it on face value, and I actually think there's a way in these horrible times when there's so little public behavior to look at and be inspired by. I choose to see this as the Conways making a very responsible and sensitive decision about their family's emotional and mental health. And I hope that's what's going on, and I hope people look at it and say, you know, that's a good example of tending to loved ones when those loved ones need tending to.
What kind of a difference do you think it could mean to Trump's campaign?
I don't think Kellyanne's departure will make a big difference. I don't get the feeling at this point in time she is, you know, one of the, you know, key figures in his reelection campaign. He kind of had fewer people to call on when he was a candidate in 2016. Because a lot of people thought that was a losing enterprise. Most people thought it was a losing enterprise. And he was just as unsavory to a lot of people then as he is now. But he's now the president of the United States. He has the ability to call on more expertise and to get more help than he did in 2016. And so I think the presence of someone like Kellyanne is less crucial now than it perhaps was then.
What do you think of how the president is painting Joe Biden? Is the kind of character assassination he is doing likely to stick in the minds of swing voters?
You know, that is the $64,000 question, because the election could turn on that precise question. There are different parts of the caricature of the vilification of Joe Biden, and I think different ones have more and less weight, right? So his caricature of Joe Biden as someone who is at this point so enfeebled, you know, mentally and physically, that he is going to be easily manipulated by whoever around him is the most expert manipulator. That so far, I don't think is working. And I think that probably won't work as long as the Joe Biden that the public sees is the Joe Biden who gave, you know, a very animated, more animated than Trump's, really, it was shorter, but more animated, gave a very animated, well-delivered convention speech. If the Joe Biden who shows up at the debates is the same Joe Biden who debated Bernie Sanders, and I use that point of reference because that debate during the Democratic primaries, the Biden-Sanders debate, was the only debate where Joe Biden had to really fill a full complement of time. Up until then, there were 10 people on the stage, or 8 people on the stage, or 6 people on the stage. If Joe Biden shows up for the Trump debates in as good form as he did to the one-on-one debate with Bernie Sanders, I don't think the enfeebled caricature will stick and influence anybody. Now, he is not going to be able to stand up to all of the leftists in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has been taken over by leftists, and he's bound to be influenced by and an expression of that. That worries me more only because of, say, what's going on in Kenosha, only because Republicans are doing such an unabashed and in its misleading and selective way, forceful job of trying to pin any violence that people see on the news on Democrats. They do such an aggressive job of saying, the mayor there's a Democrat, the governor there's a Democrat, right? Reality is more complicated than that. That worries me more. And I think it's impossible to know how that's going to play out because we have not yet seen exactly how oratorically Joe Biden's going to push back at that. I mean, I'm waiting to see over the next days the response to that speech Trump gave last night. And it's also impossible to know what are the news events going to be. Will there be another police shooting, another two police shootings at the rate things are going between now and November 3rd? Will there then be unrest in the cities or places where it happened? We don't know.
So in Kenosha last night, things calmed down, but then the protests moved back to Portland. And the question is, are those people who are protesting going to heed the idea that they are fueling Republican voters by their violence if indeed they become violent again?
Well, first of all, we should make a distinction between if we were just talking about protesters, if we were just talking about peaceful protesters, this wouldn't be an issue. And we should absolutely acknowledge the majority of people who have been protesting police violence intend to do so and do so peacefully, right? But there's this other element that has been grafted on or mixed in or whatever. The kind of people who are moved to violence, to looting, to lawlessness, to use the word, I don't think by nature they're going to stop and say, whoa, what am I doing to the political result here? Sadly, it's the peaceful protesters who I think would think about that, take it in, integrate it, respond to it. But they're not, peaceful protesters aren't the problem here in terms of what the public may be seeing and worried about. It's the people who are prone to behave in a much more irresponsible fashion. And that very character trait makes me think they're not going to sit back and say, wait, what are the political consequences of this? Am I playing into Donald Trump's hands?
More of my conversation with Frank Bruni when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Frank Bruni. He's New York Times opinion columnist. How much of a difference do you think Kamala Harris makes to the Joe Biden ticket?
I think she won't make a difference, but I think it will be a minor one. And I think it will be a minor one not because of her, but because I'm firmly in the camp that believes more often than not, the vice presidential nominee doesn't make a big difference to the outcome of an election. I mean, when people look back at history, they have an easier time finding elections in which the vice presidential nominee seemed to be a non-factor than ones in which I think Palin depressed McCain's vote count beyond where it would have been. But even there, McCain, I think, would have lost even if he'd chosen a different running mate. Remember, just kind of like really, he wanted to choose Joe Lieberman. He wanted this kind of cross-party unity ticket. I don't think that would have changed the result of that election. The reason I think Kamala could make a minor difference is I do think Black turnout is crucial here. Black turnout did not happen for Hillary Clinton to the degree that it had for Barack Obama. Had it happened in a much bigger way, it could have made a difference in some of these key states. And it's hard for me to believe that to some extent, and I can't figure out what that extent will be, Kamala Harris's opportunity to make history here, her presence on the ticket, that has to be inspiring to some voters. And so I think she could make a minor positive difference for Biden, but minor.
So how do you think that debate will go between Pence and Kamala Harris?
I think that debate is a much more dangerous one for Pence than for her, right? I think kind of symbolically, semiotically, whatever, in terms of the optics, Mike Pence, I mean, he works among Trump's most fervent supporters who aren't necessarily interested in embracing how diverse the world has become and are not kind of modern, for lack of a better word, in their orientation. Mike Pence just talks, dresses, appears, sends off the energy of such a cultural throwback, right? And Kamala obviously does the opposite. And when I think about those prized suburban voters we keep hearing about, reducing a much more complicated segment of the electorate to a cliche, I think today, 2020, Kamala Harris will be a much more relatable figure to them than Mike Pence. I also think she had some weaknesses as a candidate in the primaries. When I saw her on the stump, she didn't always move me. She didn't often exude the warmth that one could get from other candidates. But she did show she can be a very fierce debater. And she showed that in Senate committees every time she questioned someone. I think it's going to be fascinating. And I'm going to predict, and if this is true, this will drive President Trump crazy. I predict that vice presidential debate will absolutely have better ratings than at least one, if not two, of the three presidential debates.
Should Joe Biden have been more outspoken during this Republican convention when all of these charges were being made of him?
No, I don't think so, because I think he's got plenty of time to rebut them now. And because I think, you know, we have to remember, you and I are in the media, we consume media voraciously, you know, probably several hours of our day are spent consuming everything that's coming in. Most Americans, and I know you know this, but most Americans spend very little time doing that. And I think it is sort of almost futile to try to break through the noise and the kind of monopoly of attention that a party has during its political convention. And so I think there's plenty of time for Joe Biden to rebut this.
Frank, I want to go back to something you wrote last weekend, and that is this feeling among Democrats that they have to win very big. What do you mean by that, and why?
Thanks for asking about that. Yeah, I wrote a column last Sunday about that. The first thing I mean, the obvious thing I mean is, remember, is the difference between the popular vote and the Electoral College. That's the first thing. And, you know, Hillary Clinton won by almost 3 million votes. That's no small margin. And yet she lost the Electoral College, and not just by one or two votes, but by, you know, several dozen. So the nature of the popular vote Electoral College split suggests to me that Joe Biden has to win the popular vote, you know, by several million to be safe in the Electoral College, and maybe by more than 3 million, because that was Hillary Clinton's margin. But beyond that, what I mean is President Trump, in a very unscrupulous way, has made clear that he is going to question the results of this election if they show him to be the loser. He's already started to use that favorite word of his, rigged. He is planting the seeds, or whatever a more aggressive act than planting seeds would be called, to say at the tail end of this, you can't trust that result because X, Y, Z. He's going to have a harder time saying that if, say, Joe Biden has won the popular vote by 6 million and the Electoral College by 50 votes, right? And Democrats know that, and that was both openly acknowledged and implicit in something you heard at their convention that was totally new to me. I've been watching or covering these conventions for decades, and I never saw so many pauses where the moderator or speakers said, people, you have to vote. You have to have a plan to vote. You have to game out your voting options. You have to not be dissuaded. I mean, Michelle Obama's speech was a perfect example of this. I mean, she said, pack a meal, pack two meals in case you have to wait 10 hours. All of that was about the fact that they're saying, if you don't deliver Joe Biden a really, really resounding victory and an overwhelming margin, we're not going to be safe.
What about the post office?
The post office, you know, I mean, that I don't know what's going on there. It seems like the Democrats, in holding their hearing, may have shamed the administration into better behavior. It is my hope that with all of this coverage, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I tend not to see things as darkly as some of my colleagues or some of my friends. I don't think anyone in the post office anywhere is going to be throwing things in the garbage, or at least, you know, I pray not. But I do think one outcome of all of this attention is, I think those people who are voting by mail are going to send their ballots in sooner. Right? They're going to build in some wiggle room. I still have worries because there's some very interesting journalism that has come out recently about how many mail-in ballots were not counted, you know, in some of these primaries, because someone forgot to put a postmark on them, and that person was not the sender. We don't put postmarks on things we send, because they'd arrived one day late, because someone checking the signatures thought the signature didn't look precisely like what was on file. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm so rushed all the time. You could look at three different signatures of mine. They would all be mine and they would look
right.
Right. But it's that sort of ambiguity that is going to give Donald Trump an opening to say, don't trust this count, even though that count, if it's off, will as of likely have been in his favor, even if he has fewer votes, as in his there's a lot of room here for someone like Donald Trump, who is happy to undermine institutions and people's trust. There's a lot of room here for him to operate it.
And why is he so successful at undermining trust in the election process?
It goes back to the kind of information age we live in, because he is saying that to people who in recent years have so kind of collapsed and tailored their information feed in ways that open the door to conspiracy type thinking, in ways that make them more gullible to whatever message he's putting out, because they're not hearing as many countervailing contradictory. They just don't have those influences. I mean, so many Americans now live in such a kind of narrow band of information and ideological influence that he's got, I mean, the short answer, he's got a captive audience.
So, Frank, at this point and going forward, what kind of campaign are we going to see Biden run now? Is he going to have more public events, more media appearances, and does he need lots more money?
Everyone always needs more money. It does seem, though, from what I can tell, the fundraising is going pretty well. The question about whether we're going to see more physical appearances by him, the question of whether we're going to see more media interviews, that's unanswerable, because that is dependent entirely on what the polling is saying, right? So Joe Biden is a candidate who has been behaving in the ways you behave when you are protecting a lead. When you are protecting a lead, you try to eliminate as much uncertainty as you can. And every time you make an unscripted, spontaneous public appearance, every time you sit down with someone in the media, you lose a degree of control, and something can happen. Something can come out of your mouth, especially Joe Biden's mouth, that you didn't intend to. So he's limiting all of that because he's been protecting a lead, because national polls have shown him so far ahead, and because swing state polls have been favorable to him. If you can tell me what those polls will say in 3 weeks, I can tell you what his campaign will look like. The two things go hand in hand.
So by what date will you make your judgment as to whether Joe Biden is going to win or lose?
After 2016, I'm not making any judgments. No, I mean, I really learned my lesson about predict. I mean, I've written some columns that have edged up. I mean, I wrote a column a month ago, I think, or 5 weeks ago, asking the question, is Trump toast, right? And I was basically saying, if we weren't haunted by the PTSD of 2016, and we were looking, you know, at all of the numbers and dynamics here, people would be saying this is over. And we're not saying this is over because 2016 is so large in our memories. But it is large in our memories, and it does show us that you can't read the tea leaves always the way they've been read in the past and come to the right conclusion. So I will not feel confident about predicting this election, nor will I predict this election until the results come in. And even then, and this is the crazy thing about this year, Diane, even then, this election, I hope people are girded for this. This election will not be over on November 3rd. This election may not be over on December 3rd. This election may make the 2000 Florida recount look like a game of patty cake.
Frank, what happens if Trump wins again? How do you see our country going forward?
I think our country will be devastated by that. I don't mean emotionally. Well, if you were someone who didn't want Trump to win, you'll be emotionally devastated. I think Donald Trump has shown himself to be entirely corrupt in terms of the way he uses the government, in terms of the way he staffs it, in terms of what he lets the people around him do. I think he has shown time and again that the cult of Trump matters more than the integrity of democratic institutions. I think it's going to be a big, big, big problem for this country if he wins again. And luckily, because I'm an opinion journalist, a columnist, I can say that. You know, if you were interviewing me and I was covering his campaign on the news side, I wouldn't be able to say any of that. I'm scared, Diane. I'm really scared. I've written that. I'll write it again. I think when people say this is the most important election of our lifetimes, I don't think that's hyperbole.
What are you most afraid of?
in a Trump second term.
Yes.
I'm worried about a prioritization of wealth and the wealthy and the stock market that leaves no room for the kinds of regulations that we need to keep the planet healthy, to combat climate change. You know, we heard a lot of talk about regulations last night in Trump's speech, and we hear a lot of talk about regulations. And one of the reasons I care actually about having a healthy, sane Republican Party is I do think at times if Democrats govern unquestioned, they can get a little regulation happy, right? If Republicans governed unquestioned, it's the opposite. Trump is sort of, he seems to have decided that there's not a regulation that's good, right? And that matters in terms of clean air, clean water, deforestation, all that sort of stuff, right? I worry about that. I worry about what happens to kind of decency and respect for diversity. I mean, despite what you heard over 4 days at this Republican National Convention about how much he loves Black people and about how he may talk tough, but he's the most... No, this was said again and again and again. The truth of the matter is Donald Trump models a kind of divisiveness and hatred and racial inflammation that 4 more years of that coming from the person who is the head of our government and supposedly the kind of highest ranking representative of the American people. What does that do to a generation of children? What does that do to our already polluted, corroded, toxic discourse in this country? I mean, those are just some of the things I worry about. I could go on.
Before we go, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
I'd like to say vote. This is a very challenging and in some senses scary period. You know, think about voting. I mean, a lot of people have reservations about doing it in person for good reason. If you are one of those people, get a mail-in ballot. Mail it early. Make sure your signature is as close to what you've done in the past. And the other thing I want to say is one of those great political cliches is, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, right? Trump is saying, don't ask that question because it would be a resounding yes, but for the coronavirus. But the coronavirus came along and the coronavirus has taken a toll on this country that is disproportionate to every other country in the world, and especially disproportionate when you look at other affluent Western countries. I would say to people, look at that, take stock of what's going on around you, and just answer this question honestly. Would you be better off or worse off right now, including the coronavirus, if Donald Trump were or weren't president? And if you have the answer to that question, take that answer, vote accordingly. If people do that, I am relatively confident Donald Trump will not get another 4 years.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Diane, for having me.
That was Frank Bruni. He is a New York Times opinion columnist. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during these very difficult times. Please do continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Thanks for listening, all. Please do continue to wear those face coverings, not only for your safety, but the safety of others. Stay safe, be well. I'm Diane Rehm.